Today's Teisho will be on Case 15 in Entangling Vines. Case 15 is entitled, One Peak is Bare. A monk asked Kaoshan Benji, all of the peaks are covered with snow. Why is this one bare? Kaoshan said, you should recognize distinction within distinction. The monk said, what is distinction within distinction? Kaoshan said, not falling into being the color of the other mountains. Peaks are covered with snow. Why is this one bare? This one bare. So this is really a wonderful koan, you know. I guess nobody wants to be that peak, right? Nobody wants to be that. All the other peaks in the mountain are covered with snow, and this one is bare. And nobody necessarily wants to be that peak, you know. Yesterday I was talking about how we, you know, when we leave our house and we go out into the world, we're looking for people to look at us through the loving eyes of our mother. That was what I said. That is really part of studying the self. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all beings. So this koan is sort of connected to yesterday's koan. Nobody wants to be the white peak. I mean, the peak that isn't covered with snow, the bare peak. You know, when I've told this story many times, but it's I think illustrative in a lot of ways. You know, when Genki Roshi came to Seattle, it was I think 1977 or 1976. And, things were so different then. It would be hard to, for people born in the last 20 years, it would just be hard for you to imagine what a different time that was, you know. I hope you won't mind my ruminations, you know, as an older man. But I was at a party the other night, and I met a man who was my age, and he had been in Colorado in that same period. He just said, oh, you know, I was living in a teepee up in the mountains, and he had been using magic mushrooms, he belonged to a drumming group, you know. And now he works in New York in finance or something. And he just said, oh man, how I'd love to go back to, you know, smoking a joint in the hot tub, basically, and listening to philosophy on a tape of philosophy or something. So that was sort of the style of the times. And it was very open, very experimental, and I would say somewhat different from now. You know, it's not so open, not so experimental. So when Genki Roshi came from Japan, Seattle was sort of like a very youthful community. I mean, the average age in the city of Seattle was probably around 32 or something. It was pretty amazing. And there was quite a large sort of like a counterculture in Seattle. So when Genki Roshi came, you know, I think like 100 people showed up one time to hear him talk. And I myself was very interested in Zen. You know, I had read some books on Buddhism, and I thought it was very exciting. And I was, sort of open to possibilities. Nothing was going on in my life at that time. I was moving furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company, and I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So, you know, I didn't know. I'd gone through undergraduate school. I liked to read. I was moving furniture, and this Zen master came from Japan. And when I heard him talk myself, I was really inspired to practice. And Zen definitely helped me. I mean, I think that it's quite likely that I had, I was a little bit depressed. I probably had an anxiety disorder. And I didn't really know it, and I didn't know how to deal with my anxiety disorder except to stay out of situations that create anxiety, which means you can never go out of your room, right? Basically I was sort of getting by, and Genki Roshi came. And he was a most amazing person, you know. Began to be his student, I really wanted to be like Genki Roshi. You know, he was kind of an ideal person to me. You know, first of all, everybody respected him. You know, when he came to Seattle, 100 people came to see him speak. Some of those people were like professors at the University of Washington. They were, people I admired, and people I understood other people admired. You know, I met my second teacher, Glenn Webb, at one of these talks that Genki was giving. And another one of my friends, John Sunston, was people who became my friends through Zen, was a researcher on brain science at the University of Washington. So, I was this guy moving furniture, and I went to this talk, and I became a member of the Zen group, and I was in a group with people who were like who had architectural firms, and people who were professors of neuroscience, and art historians, and they all really respected Genki Roshi. I definitely wanted to be respected too, you know, which is a totally normal and worthwhile pursuit. You know, it's we all want to be respected. We all want to be admired by others. And Zen was exciting to me for a lot of reasons, not just that people admired Genki, but you know, it spoke to me on a very deep level. So, you know, when I began to do koan practice, I had a lot of fantasies about how it was supposed to go. You know, I've mentioned this before, but I had read these books by this man named Lobsang Rampa, who is, that sounds like a Tibetan name, and he pretended to be a Tibetan. He basically was not a Tibetan. He was, I think, from California or someplace like that. Oh, I'm sorry, he was English, my mistake. And he wrote these books that were international bestsellers that claimed to be exposés of life in Tibet. And Tibet was still very closed off, you know, still very mysterious. And Lamsang Rampa talked about communicating with other people mentally, telepathically. He talked about being able to, he said Buddhist monks in Tibet fly through the air on giant kites, you know. He created this world that was fascinating, you know. And also at this time, very popular books were called the Don Juan books. An anthropologist named Carlos Castaneda had gone to Mexico and found a Native American holy man who was taking Castaneda through the ancient ways of knowledge of the Yaqui Indians. And it involved using peyote, and they had, and the books are, if you ever read the books, they're incredibly riveting. When I read these books, I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is astonishing, you know. He's in, Castaneda's in Mexico, he's doing research, and he runs into this this shaman, this holy man named Don Juan. And Don Juan initiates him into this ancient knowledge, right, you know. And Castaneda wrote these books and became a best-selling author. And, you know, later anthropologists looked at his work and decided that it wasn't real. But at the time, everybody in the anthropology community really loved these books. So anyway, I was reading Lobsang Rampa and I was reading Don Juan. And I started studying with Genki Roshi, and I thought, you know, things are really going to happen. You know, maybe I won't communicate telepathically right away, but, you know, sooner or later, at the end of one of Don Juan's books, Don Juan tells Castaneda, you have this magical power you can use to jump off a cliff. And at the end of the book, he says he and Don Juan jump off this high cliff. And I don't know how many people were killed as a result of that passage, but, you know, he's saying all laws of physics can be suspended if you have magical powers. So, you know, anyway, I was hoping Zen would be like that, you know, that I would have, you know, I would have extraordinary insights and extraordinary powers. This was sort of in the air, you know, sort of in the spirit of the times, was anything is possible and so on. So then, you know, I began to do a koan practice, and it was not at all what I thought it was going to be. I really did think that Genki Roshi was going to, you know, we would go into a room together and he would say, okay, now do this. A friend of mine told me I should go see Doctor Strange, the movie Doctor Strange. He said you'd really love this movie. I don't know if you've seen the movie Doctor Strange, but it's about this guy who has magical powers and all this stuff, you know. And I went to the movie, and I would have liked that movie 40 years ago a lot. It's not Buddhism, however, if I may say so. You know, so anyway, you know, when I started training with Genki Roshi, I started doing koan training, and he said, "I want you to watch the breath," and I thought, okay, you know, I'll play your little game. You know, this must be some kind of a test, right? You know, so you know, I came in and I said, "Yeah, okay, I've been watching the breath. It goes in my nose and out my nose. You know, now give me the secrets. You know, the real stuff." And he said, no, he said, that's okay. He said, but I'd like you to, you know, please explore the breath a little more. And you know, I was working on the breath koan for the longest time. I wanted, it's definitely a good thing that I admired Genki Roshi. You know, because he really did change my life in the best possible way. And he was somebody you could really trust. You know, he was a wonderful person. But, you know, on the other hand, I was also kind of a prisoner of my admiration for him, you know, because I wanted so much to say something special or do something special that would earn his praise, you know. So basically, I wanted my answers on the breath perception koan to really be, you know, enlightened answers, you know. I had tried saying, well, my breath goes in, my breath goes out, you know, and then I would just watch the breath, and I'd go in, nothing would happen. I'd go to see Genki Roshi, and I'd say, well, I'm watching the breath. He'd say, yes, well, just watching the breath, ding. this went on, and then I thought, okay, well, maybe I can be creative. Maybe he's asking me to be creative. You know, so reciting poetry, bringing him flowers, things like this. And then, you know, I wound up working on the breath koan for like forever. It seemed like for years, literally. And Genki Roshi, when he came to Seattle, attracted like a core group of about 50 people. And we were all young, and we were all had similar excitement about this Zen master. And, you know, we would go to sesshins, and everybody would answer their koans. They'd go into the Dokusan room, they'd be in there for 20 minutes, they'd come out, and I would go into the Dokusan room, and I'd be there for like under a minute. So you know, it began to really bother me that I wasn't becoming successful. I wasn't becoming good at this, you know, because I put a lot of chips in the Zen basket. You know, I wasn't doing anything much with my life. I was moving furniture, and that's a good thing to do. We need people to move furniture, but I wasn't really turned on. I was basically getting a check. You know, I wasn't really excited by moving furniture. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And so, you know, Zen was supposed to be, in a certain way, you know, the way I could be excellent, or the way I could be noticed and praised. And Genki Roshi was a wonderful guy. And I was terrified, really, to be open or honest with him. You know, I remember, I've mentioned this before, but you know, he gave me he made ceramics, and he gave each person in our group a tea bowl. It was like he personally made this tea bowl, and gave it to me. I usually kept it behind my cushion in the Zendo, but once a year the Zendo closed for like 3 weeks while Genki Roshi went on vacation, and we all had to take our zafus and our zabutons home, and we took our tea bowls home, and so I had the tea bowl on a shelf. And somebody came over to my house, and I was now in graduate school, so a friend of mine from graduate school came over to the house, and I said, you know, I was given a bowl, a very special, precious bowl, by a Zen master, you know, and this guy's a great Zen master, and he gave me this bowl, right? And I didn't quite put it like that, but I was definitely cashing in on my association with Genki Roshi. And I was handing him the bowl, and it like it was magical. It just like flew out of my hands and fell on the floor. And I was so afraid that Genki Roshi would think less of me that I actually went around town talking to ceramics people, trying to get this thing put back together again. Or I even talked to people about, could you do something that was a close imitation of this, you know? So when I brought it back, Genki Roshi wouldn't notice. So when the training period started up again, I went back to the training period, and I had my cushions, but I didn't have my bowl, and I just borrowed one of the tea bowls that we had, sort of like the generic tea bowl. And every day Genki Roshi would say, well, where's your tea bowl? And I was like, oh, I left it at home, you know, and so on. I was so afraid to say to him, I broke the tea bowl, right? I wanted to be an exceptional student. I wanted him to say, you are really an amazing Zen student. And instead, he had given me this tea bowl that he made himself, and I had, being a clumsy ox, you know, I dropped it on the ground. So, you know, eventually I told Genki Roshi, finally, I broke the tea bowl. And he went, oh, 1 minute. And he went downstairs and got me another tea bowl. The end. But I had invested this with so much anxiety, right? I think this is, you know, I think that everybody's, I mean, maybe you're different. But, you know, we all, I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be admired, right? There's nothing wrong with wanting to be respected. You know, when we leave our house and we go out into the world, we definitely want to be praised and liked, and that's, and good things come from that, you know. People do make wonderful contributions, but, you know, you can be trapped by that desire to be, you know, to be what other people want you to be. You know, in our Zen group, we used to have a system where people would be appointed as officers. So one of the officers was the cook, called a Tenzo. And the Roshi would ask you to serve as cook for 6 months. So your job was to basically, we used to do 4 sesshin a year. Your job was to give up, you know, basically 6 months of your training and come to sesshin and be in charge of the cooking. And Genki Roshi finally asked many people to be Tenzo over the years, and I was always relieved not to be asked. Because when you were Tenzo, pretty much, it wasn't like here where everybody contributes to making the food. More or less, the Tenzo and an assistant or two was in charge of making all the meals and getting that done. And usually in our group, the Tenzo, the cook, did very little sitting. Pretty much it was just like getting all these meals ready in the kitchen. So you were really giving up 6 months of your practice. And I definitely didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted to be an excellent student, and all my fellow students were answering their koans, and I didn't want to take 6 months out of my time to be the cook. Because after all, you know, who wants to be the cook? You know what I mean? I wanted to be, you know, the head monk, not the cook. You know, eventually Genki Roshi said, I'd like you to be the Tenzo. And of course, you couldn't say no. So I said, okay, you know, I will do this. You know, the interesting thing was, this was really when I began to understand Zen a tiny little bit. Because you know, I had been seeing Zen as a, like, almost like a competition, you know. It's like a race to approval or a race to recognition. You know, so I was going to, in my mind, I was going to become the kind of student who would go into the Dokusan room, answer his koan. The teacher would go, my God, you know, you're answering one koan a day, can they make it two? You know, you're a great Zen master. You know, you're going to be a great Zen master, you know. And so instead, I wound up cooking in the kitchen. And with the greatest reluctance, I agreed to do this because there was no way to back out. But, you know, actually, as it turned out, one of my jobs before I became the student in the Zen Center was to be a cook in an Italian restaurant. That's where I met my wife. And I learned how to make Italian food very well. I'm actually a pretty good Italian cook. And I have some experience in the kitchen. And so when Genki Roshi asked me to do this, I agreed to do it reluctantly. But then, you know, when I began to cook for the group, it was like it overwhelmed me, you know, in a good way. Like cooking became interesting again, you know. And I began to, you know, in preparation for the sesshin, I was getting recipes, and it was like, I didn't really expect any benefit from this. I just got interested in making food. And I was actually making little things at home and trying them out on my wife before sesshin. And I had like a scrapbook of recipes. And then, you know, when the sesshin happened, You know, I really just decided, you know, it was like I wasn't trying to get brownie points. You know, I didn't think this would benefit me in any way. I didn't think the Roshi would associate my being a good cook with any kind of advancement in Zen. It was just something I got into. You know, I just found I really like cooking. I really enjoy this. And I began to really want to make good meals for everybody. And I made incredibly good meals for everybody. I even made, everything was vegetarian, but I even made a dish with tofu, and if you know what béarnaise sauce is, it's a very difficult sauce to make. And I made a béarnaise sauce, you know, it was on tofu, Genki Roshi came into the kitchen. He said, you know, that was fantastic, you know. So, you know, I was making cornbread and leaving it out for people after the sit as they're going back to their rooms. You know, they could have a little cornbread snack. And I would actually peek through the door because our kitchen was right next to the dining room, like here. And I could look out and I could see the faces of people eating and enjoying their meal, you know? And I would feel so good about that. So, you know, this was really like the beginning of my understanding of Zen. Because, you know, I had associated Zen with this sort of like struggle for recognition or approval, you know? When I realized I wasn't going to be recognized and I wasn't going to be approved, you know, I kind of just put that on the back burner and did this thing very grudgingly. But when I began to do it, like, it became a very wholehearted activity. I discovered, not that I hadn't done things to help other people before, but I discovered, you know, the pleasure that comes from taking care of other people, which I had not really experienced in so profound a way. You know, when my second sesshin was over, Genki Roshi called me into the Dokusan room. And by the way, I was still working on the breath perception koan. I went into Dokusan and I said, well, I haven't had a chance to practice very much. I've been watching the breath and I don't have anything to report, you know. And Genki Roshi said, you know, I'm passing you on this koan anyway. He said, because, you know, of your being such a good cook. He said, you know, I have never seen you do anything to help other people in our group before. This is really something that was a totally selfless act on your part. I was flabbergasted, you know, really, because I had not expected to be rewarded for this. It gave me a lot of things to think about, you know, in terms of why I was practicing. It's definitely the case that I poisoned my practice by trying to be excellent at it, you know. I actually think many things are like this in life, you know. When I was buying groceries a few days ago for the sesshin, I was waiting in line, and there was this very nice older woman in front of me who was counting out all her coupons. And she had like 80 coupons. And so it was like, uh-oh, the coupons, right? And the woman behind the counter is going through the coupons, like, these are the ones we'll accept, these are the ones we won't accept. So, you know, we're going through all our coupons. And I pulled off a New Jersey magazine, you know, and I opened it up and it says Top Docs of New Jersey, right? And you look at the faces of all these doctors who are like the top docs, right? And you think, you know, I have to say I have an excellent doctor And, you know, he wasn't in the top docs, but I think he's the top doc, you know. Well, he wasn't in New Jersey's top docs, and I hope he doesn't look at that magazine and think, oh, damn it, I'm not a top doc. When we do things to, when we do things that way, often we have like a, it has a desperate quality, right? It's like there's a desperation to it, right? When we're trying to be approved of, or we're trying to be real to ourselves, you know, I'm trying, please make me real to myself. You know, but I think my doctor, he's a wonderful guy. He's a great doctor. You know, he does all of this pro bono work. He comes over to Rutgers and he teaches math to minority students. You know, it's like, he's the best doctor in the world, I think, you know. I don't think he gets any money for teaching students at Rutgers. I don't think he has a plaque on his wall. I think he does it because it gives him pleasure, the pleasure of helping others, you know. And so, you know, this is a different way to live, right? It's a different way to live, you know, learning how to get outside yourself and care for other people, you know, is really, I think, a superior way to live. You know, and it's okay to pat yourself on the back. It's okay, I hope my doctor does go home and say, you know, I'm a pretty damn good doctor, you know? Because he is. And it's not sinful or egotistical to be proud of what you do or what you are. But, you know, there's a motivation issue, you know? When your behavior has a kind of desperate quality, you know, when you feel like everything's on the line because of this, right? Everything's on the line because of this. You know, usually you should be suspicious of your motivations. You know, people don't always give themselves, you know, I was so lucky that Genki Roshi asked me to be the Tenzo, because I never gave myself permission, basically, not to worry about what other people thought, and just to act from my true nature. You know, I never gave myself permission, space to explore that possibility. So, you know, definitely, if you come to Sesshin and you're worried about how long you're spending on your koan or who's answering a koan, you're really poisoning your own well. You know, if you think about your Zen training as an opportunity to basically be a part of a bigger life, you know, I think it will be much better for you on and off the cushion. I'm sure you're familiar with Georgia O'Keeffe. You know, she was interviewed I remember this interview. I still have a copy of it in my house. And the artist said, how does it feel to be the greatest American artist of your generation? And Georgia O'Keeffe said, I'm not the greatest artist of my generation. You don't know the name of the greatest artist of my generation. And nobody does. But she said, basically, I've seen so many great artists who nobody knows about. And I'm by far not the greatest artist, you know. And I don't think that was false modesty. You know, basically, when she was saying, you know, if you're going to be an artist and you're worried about people's approval, you're going to be an unhappy artist. But if you're doing something you love that makes you feel more alive, then you're on the right path. So, you know, in a way, we all need to be educated into how to find our path, you know. Very few of us really give ourselves permission to stop seeking approval and to basically say, what makes me feel more alive? You know, in a way, Zen practice is learning how to turn away from that mind that seeks approval and learning how to listen to this part of ourselves that feels like alive or joyous or connected or compassionate. This is day two of Sesshin. You know, this is actually a moment where, we're moving out of the, there's a self we are much of the time, which is this self that's seeking approval from others. You know, it's very deep behavior. It's a human behavior. But on day two of Sesshin, sometimes you find yourself asking, who am I really? You're stepping out of that identity or out of that familiar place. And you're in kind of an uncertain place, right? Maybe you feel a little bit uneasy, or maybe you feel, you're not quite sure where you're standing right now. And that feeling is really important. That's the beginning of making this transition from, seeking the approval of others to beginning to be honest with yourself and really beginning to discover who you really are, what you really are. So day two can be a hard day. We have a lot of pain, and we have a lot of, sometimes we're tired, But this is a chance to sort of stop doing the maintenance work on maintaining the self-image you think people expect of you, which is a very exhausting experience, right? And beginning to act from a more spontaneous place. Now, this is not always so easy, however. It's not always so easy to let go because, we spend a lot of time and energy maintaining our appearance, and also, we spend a lot of time and energy locking ourselves up, so to speak. Locking ourselves up. We are constantly, just speaking from my own experience, I definitely was my own jailer and my own policeman. I locked myself off in a million different ways for a long time. And Zen really helped me to get in touch with something more spontaneous than that. Day two is usually where we're beginning to make that transition. You don't quite know who you are, and you don't quite know how to answer your koan, but that's actually a wonderful opportunity. Answering your koan means discovering who you really are. One more little story. I sometimes work with graduate students who come to graduate school and they go through 3 years of classwork. And at the end of their classwork, they've read all this stuff, and sometimes I will meet with a graduate student and I'll say to them, okay, so what are you going to do your dissertation on? What would you like to do? And they're literally stunned. It's like they don't know what to say because they haven't allowed themselves to say, well, what would I like to do? And a lot of the times they're literally stumped. They say, I have to think that over. And then, they usually decide, I'll do what Professor Jones wants me to do. But they don't haven't given themselves permission to be uncertain, drifting in blankness, and so on. So day two, you can feel like you don't quite know where to put your feet, like you don't know who you are, and you don't know what you're doing. It's like, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? Those are all quite familiar experiences. This sort of transitional period is usually followed by like a time somewhere in the Sesshin where you will connect with a deeper part of yourself. Something stirring in yourself wants to come to life. It wants to come to life. And we don't always allow it any oxygen, you know. So even the physical challenges are part of liberating that self in you that wants to come to life. So please trust the process. If you're feeling a little bit at odds and ends, if you're feeling a little bit like the lonely little peak that's bare and all the other mountains are covered with snow. You know, every mountain in the mountain range is thinking the same thing, see? All the mountains are saying, oh my God, all the other peaks are better than I am, or more real than I am, or more fulfilled than I am. See, but you have to be the best peak you can be. And that doesn't mean fulfilling somebody else's expectations. It means getting in touch with that part of yourself that wants to come to life. A monk asked Kaoshan Benji, "Snow covers 1,000 mountains. Why is this one bare?" Kaoshan said, "You should recognize distinction within distinction." A monk said, "What is distinction within distinction?" Kaoshan said, "Not falling into being the color of the other mountains." Distinction within distinction means basically you are going to move away from the self you created to please others, and you're going to discover the self inside you that wants to be free.